monetary wealth, if you will, via cattle, and as well as precious metals and things of this nature. And his everything he did, basically, in spite of his weaknesses, God blessed him and greased his skids, and it was noticeable by those around him in that respect. And it is no different in regards to, obviously, any place that he might live, those who would be privy of his presence, of his activities, and he would obviously probably engage in business activities with these others around him in this regards, and he was held with great respect, if you will, in regards to his very person and reputation for those around him. This speaks highly, obviously, of his witness of the life, and that that was not discolored in regards to, if you will, his wealth, his power otherwise. What you get from these verses, people was attracted to Abraham for who and what he was, for not what he had. See. Often it is different. People are attracted to others for their assets, physical assets otherwise. But I don't get this at all in regard to the sons of Heth and their response to Abraham. For here, and it's seen here in this language, they regarded him as a, quote, prince among us. The Hebrew, Nashi Atah Bet Toek, end quote. That by itself is a designation of honor. But then they add, of God, Elohim, in the Hebrew. So that shows an exalted status that he's regarded in and of itself, a prince among us. But then they add in, of God. And that reflects their orientation to what he represents as a person. So, five, now, and this is why I've revised this a little bit. Translators have taken Elohim contextually here into superlative and translated it mighty. A translation not unique in the Old Testament, though the plural use is unique to Genesis in and of itself. To translate it as such, Genesis 30, verse 8, it is obvious that that is how it should be translated in that vein. In Rachel and Leah's competitive nature is the idea here. But anyway, she has a second son for Jacob in verse 8. So Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister. That word mighty is Elohim. So that is the implication. El denotes power, might, etc. And I have indeed prevailed, and she named him Naphtali. So we see it there translated as mighty in the plural, Elohim. Otherwise, outside of Genesis, the alternate translation of mighty is usually simply El in the singular, El, such as Joshua 22:22. The mighty one, God, the Lord. There, El in the singular, followed with Elohim in the plural. Hence a description of God in his might and his power. The mighty one, God, the Lord. He knows. May Israel self know. Job 41:25. this is a description of, if you will, a creature, a mighty creature that existed during the time of Job, immediately after the flood. It was obviously around pre-diluvian, but existed also post-diluvian. The description of this particular creature is unique in and of itself. Like spitting fire out of his mouth. Nostrils going, smoke coming out of his nostrils. That was this verses 19 and 20. It pictures a dragon as we would understand a dragon. It was one of the most feared animals, creatures, that reside on this planet. One, obviously, that any hunter that had any desire to claim notoriety for skills. If you can take down one of these, that's a trophy to have. And it is in that context that we see our word mighty used with respect to fear that this creature would cause upon others. And even those who were the most adept at hunting and skills of that nature, it's not going in and taking on a grizzly or some powerful gun and going to go hunt an elephant. This animal struck fear in everybody's hearts when they were in his periphery. That's verse 25. When he, that's Leviathan, raises himself up, the mighty fear. Alternate translation, gods in the small g, those who may exalt themselves otherwise. But obviously the idea of powerful people, mighty, is the idea. Because of the crashing, they are bewildered. This animal could raise more than Cain. Large, formidable, in such a degree that it went crazy on you. Just the noise it can make would be enough to put your heart up in your throat, if not something else. Also, Psalm 29:1. These just a few examples, and it's used elsewhere, translated mighty elsewhere, etc. Psalm 29:1. Ascribe to the Lord, O sons of the mighty. There, legitimately, you might translate that gods, but it's translated in the New American Standard again as mighty. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Mighty. Looking at what one ascribes to God as being omnipotent, see, is the idea there. So, hence why I put mighty in parentheses in regards to the translation. So again, point five, translators have taken Elohim contextually in the superlative and translated it mighty, a translation not unique in the Old Testament. So I've kept it in there as a New American Standard, as otherwise translated, you are a mighty prince among us. Yet, that's not all that's being said here. Six, now the translation, literal translation, a prince of Elohim in the Hebrew. The prince of Elohim. Taking that phrase would be recognition on their part of the blessing of God upon this man that had resided among the peoples of Canaan now for some 60 plus years from the time he set foot in the land around 1871 B.C. now to 1809 B.C. So he'd been a resident some 60 years. and obviously many opportunities for people to evaluate him, observe him, and see how his life went. So the phrase Prince of Elohim would couple in their thinking this man who represents as prophet God, that he obviously is considered to be held in high esteem by God with respect to how God has blessed him and success he's had in life in this respect. So, seven here, to tie this together, there is logic here to think that Moses had both ideas in mind by utilizing this phrase, that is, both mighty and God, as it fits Abraham both politically, seeing his strength, his power through his military advantage, his economic advantage, as well as spiritually. Eight, we saw the same type of recognition coming from Abimelech and Phicol in Genesis 21:22. It's the same type, if you will, of addressing Abraham in this regard. They said, God is with you in all that you do. Their observation. See. And obviously, coming from a king and a military commander, that is all-inclusive in regards to Abraham's status economically as well as spiritually. And a verse that, remembering back, I think is documentation that they became believers, were evangelized out of that whole ordeal. Those are the kinds of things that just blows Fundy's minds. These types of passages of Scripture that a believer can go in and screw things up as royal as what Abraham and Sarah did in regards to Operation, Sarah in regards to Abimelech. And yet, out of it comes Paul's volition being evangelized. That is this. The Fundy mentality is you got to get in there and you got to sell yourself. If your nose ain't clean, you're not going to have an impact in regards to people around you, in regards to your life, if it's not kept clean at all times. And you're not perfect in certain ways, see. Otherwise, you're going to drive people away. Don't believe it. That's not what the Scriptures teach. It's not what the Scriptures reveal. If God is dependent upon us to save people, then why doesn't He make us perfect so that we can be a pristine example in regards to, if you will, our moral and ethical aspects of life at all times? Hey, you got to get that kind of thinking out of your mind. It's that old salesmanship technique approach in regards to the Scriptures. And from that, you get all other kinds of distortions. Invading people's privacy, knocking on people's doors at supper time. Standing on a street corner, screaming at the top of lungs, and people laughing at you, giving Christianity a black eye in that respect. And other aspects. Obviously, we have a responsibility of witness. And we're not avoiding that. But this idea that somehow if you are not at this standard of righteousness that is perceived by such a legalistic religious idea, that you're not worthy to be a witness for God and evangelize otherwise, that is nothing but phooey. That's just the way it is. I've had multiple opportunities to witness to people, and it's been effective. And guess what? There was some times that I was living a life that would probably, vibrate a few people that knew about it. Let's see. No, it's the truth. The net for fishing for men is the truth of Bible doctrine. Everything else is secondary to that. again, you can't, you know, dismiss your responsibility of being in fellowship. Isolation is a sin nature. Heck, I knew a guy back when that he was out of Bible class. He peeled out of Bible class, and he had an employee that was working for him, and he witnessed to him and said, you know, I'm out of Bible class. That's where you should be. So I'm out. Well, how come you don't? Well, I'm out. I'm stupid. I blew out. I don't under my STA, etc. Next thing you know, the guy shows up in Bible class. Yeah, a bad witness being a witness otherwise to positive volition. God knows exactly what it takes. He knows exactly the words people need to hear. That's why when we do witness, we have opportunity to witness, you just get in fellowship and let Bible doctrine and God the Holy Spirit lead you and guide you in the things that you say and do, and live your life in such fashion. And God will bring about the opportunities otherwise. It's good to know that people going to heaven or going to hell is not dependent upon me. I don't need that kind of pressure. Whether somebody gets a prize is not dependent upon me. I don't need that kind of pressure. I want the prize. I'm going for it. People want to get on the bandwagon with me? Well, fine. But whether they get it or not, apart from the teaching the truth of Bible doctrine, yeah, the burden's on yourself. So, again, I'm not disassociating my responsibilities, my witness. I know my godliness code. Trust me, I know it. Where I have to maintain myself. But that witness comes in a different way than usually as it's colored by the religious legalistic types out there in the world. It's your fidelity to the directed will of God functioning in your life in a consistent fashion, in spite of your SCA weaknesses along the way. So, it's my thinking, it's my interpretation that Moses intentionally uses a term that can have an altered translation in this capacity. In this context, with Abraham, to bring out all aspects in regards to his notoriety to those around him as not only being politically or militarily and economically great among them, but also he was known to be a spiritual witness and a spiritual great among them as a prophet in this regards. So 9 is as if the sons of Heth had also been evangelized and recognized Abraham for the prophet he was. Remember Genesis 27 when God revealed himself to Abimelech in the dream. He told Abimelech, he's a prophet. So Abraham had a responsibility in his nomadic lifestyle. To obviously communicate the truth of Bible doctrine to those who might give him an ear otherwise in that respect. A prophet in the Old Testament is a communicator of Bible doctrine, one who proclaims the issues in regards to God's plan for one's life. And the sons of Heth and their response to Abraham gives indication that they have heard words from him concerning God's plan, and that obviously would be, as it would pertain and centered on the covenant that God had with Abraham and the issues behind that covenant. What a lead-in. I'm a representative of God. God spoke to me. One of these days, all this territory is going to be part of my possession. But really, one of the important thing is from my lineage, there is going to be a promised heir. And that's where everything centers on, see. How he takes the covenant and he puts it into his doctrinal perspective in regard to evangelizing phase one, as it might be in this respect. So Elisha at the minimum, in this regard, is as if the sons of Eli have been evangelized by him. And they're acknowledging him for being a representative of God and God blessing him in all things. Then 10 at the very least, it does reflect Matthew 5:16. As I have written out for it, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works. That good works is application, divine good production. That's applying Bible doctrine. And glorify your Father who is in heaven. That's in spite of your STA failings otherwise. And that comes about for us, obviously, in regards to living in this dispensation, in establishing our priorities under NPR, employing rebound, and doing your work as unto the Lord, your relationships and things of this nature, and applying Bible doctrine otherwise. A representation, a divine viewpoint, in contrast to human viewpoint that bombards us everywhere we go. See, and opportunities in that respect. To let your light shine. It's not this some pictured non-visual in you, in you know, someone who comes off as being like the Pope, sinless almost. No, it's divine good production. Being in Bible class, rebound, applying under your spiritual gift. Not letting other things and other issues and other people in life to compromise that. That's what gives the witness. See? I can't be your friend. I can't go out and hang out with you every weekend, party with you every weekend. Because you and I, we don't have anything in common really when it comes down to our spiritual life. I am not going to accept this job because it takes me out of Bible class. We all have to miss on occasion, I understand that. But I'm not going to transfer halfway across the country so that I can get a raise because it's going to take me away from my right shepherd and my Bible class. See, that's your witness. Well, can't you find a church there? Quite honestly, not like ours. How do I know that? Have you ever been to one of our parties? But anyway. See? It's different. We've all been on, most of us, been on Bible doctrine long enough to recognize what I'm talking about. One of my best friends in life, pre-doctrinal days, after I got on doctrine, he had kept contact with me, even though it was obviously fairly isolated. And he got on doctrine, and he told me the reason why. He says, I heard what came from your mouth, I saw what you was doing, but you hadn't changed a bit. Yet you could articulate the plan of God to me like, you know, I'd never heard before, and he was raised in a funding church. So there you have it. The doctrine doesn't change you. It may change the way we act, our focus in life, and things of this nature. But your personality remains the same. And for some people, that's a hard pill to swallow. At the very minimum, divine good production. That's our opportunity for witness. Whether you're on the job, whether you're at school, see, to put doctrine as your priority in those things that you're willing to engage in or not engage in, etc., etc. And these things glorify God the Father as He resides and manifests Himself in the throne room of the third heaven. Don't worry about the rest of it. My boss is, he's mean, mean-spirited, he's abusive. So, do your work as unto the Lord. And maybe that's the burden that you carry. That's where you're going to get unbelievable divine good production, at least for that part in time of your life, until God determines to deliver you or whatever. See? You don't have to be like the rest and bad-mouthing and gossip about him and all these other things. People flip you off in the traffic. You don't have to flip them off back. Or flip them back off. I don't know how to do that. Even though you may on occasion. So, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works. And glorify your Father who is in heaven. Abraham was a prime example of that type of person. And all that he did. You can see that he would give recognition to where it belonged in regards to his activities and his focus and successes in life. To God, Bible doctrine, his priorities, his faith in the passive sense as well as active, which is active would be evident through his good works. So 11, in spite of any temporary STA failings on Abraham's part, his witness to others had great impact. Two times he failed, as we have recorded. And obviously, he's had more STA issues than this. We're not blind. He had an STA just like the rest of us. I mean, just like the rest of us. Every great believer in the Bible had an STA just like the rest of us. They had the same mental attitude conflicts and other palpitations that the STA obviously drives people to do the things that they do. How are they successful? How are they overcome it? By believing with active faith in the truth of Bible doctrine and making it their priority and application of it in their life. And in that way, God will use you. He will use you when he so determines to witness to others, in spite of whatever your STA failings may be otherwise, as we stated. And his witness obviously had great impact. 12, now the phrase, bury your dead, kabar muth, here is a positive statement, as in, quote, in the choices of our graves, as is, quote, in the choices of our graves, bet mebekar kaber. 13, this is then followed by a negative statement. None of us, not a man from us, will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. Ish min kaber lo kala min kabar muth. 14, this is a remarkable offer, considering Abraham was an outsider that moved about the land and tended to remain aloof from the locals. There's no indication that he hobnobbed with these people or with anybody else. Things were just done under terms of business transaction or as would be appropriate otherwise. The opportunity to invite people in regards to a feast of those who would be appropriate, etc. Fine. So the fact that they were not willing to hold back from any man, every person there, in essence, was in agreement. Whatever you want from us, any one of us, for your to bury your dead, you've got it. It's yours. Considering the fact that he's an outsider on top of it all. 15, the positive then negative statement suggests that these Hittites too want to do right before God, pointing to positive volition. That's the implication at least. 16, Abraham illustrates that you don't have to pursue those in the cosmos to evangelize, but that God will provide the situations necessary one way or the other. It's silent in regards to how any of these might have been evangelized or otherwise. It's just succinct statements by them that gives you that recognition. See, you're a prince of God. We see that. See, so you plug in, you live your life, opportunity will be provided as God so deems as necessary. And sometimes you may have long dry spells. But that's the way it is. So 17, if these Hittites were believers, it would lend credence for Abraham's approach to them other than just picking some men at random hoping for the best. Why did he go to these particular people? Well, he had something in mind. But obviously, I think there's more to it. When you go to engage in a business transaction, usually you have things scoped out and things in place to know exactly what you're dealing with and why you would go there. And the fact that they would more or less be believers would be a good reason to approach them otherwise in this respect for this, if you will, proposition. 18, it would add a level of confidence for him that his needed request would be received positively. He went there and he fully expected them to respond favorably on his behalf. 19, this in addition to the fact that he is held in the same esteem as one of their own princes or tribal chiefs. When your reputation precedes you, obviously you know what to expect walking in. 20, their offer appears to be sincere, warm, and generous on their behalf. There's nothing fake about this. It's not like they're trying to nuzzle up to him for economic reasons or anything of this nature. A very open, sincere, generous offer. 21, however, none actually offered to sell Abraham the real estate, only to share access to their own. To bury wherever you want on our property is the idea. Take a break.